It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
I'm Em. I'm a collective member of Lobelia Commons, he, him, and yeah, been a part of it since it started last year at the beginning of the pandemic.
Hi, I'm Hadley. I use they, them pronouns, and I'm a part of Lobelia Commons, and I also live and work at a farm project a little bit outside New Orleans called Indian Bayou Food Forest.
This is the second time we've had the chance to talk. People want to go back and listen to the first time we discussed a project that you were at that time just getting off the ground. It was the Earthbound Farmer's Almanac. And since our discussion, you all have printed an issue and now you're in the process of getting submissions for the second issue, which I believe ends, the call for submissions ends at the end of this month. So if you're listening to this, you may have a couple days just to squeak in a submission. But we definitely encourage people to check out the first publication, and we look forward to the second. But let's just kind of go back before we talk about a lot of other stuff. Tell us about, first of all, putting out that first issue. I mean, we're in a world now where print, a lot of people say, is dead. I know this is a really exciting project. Talk to us about, you know, putting it out. What was the response, and what was the process like for getting it out across such a wide area?
Yeah, so I think the response was like pretty resounding. I think all of us were pretty surprised when we first were talking about doing it. I think like I floated maybe printing 2,000 or something, because when you print through 2,000 or, you know, a larger number, it gets a little bit cheaper. But everyone was like, ah, it seems, that's wild. That's way too many. And we had even talked about printing it ourselves at one point. But we ended up printing in three, across three different printings. I think we did like 3,000 or something like that.
Yes.
Something like that. But yeah, and we just like went through them really quickly. I think they really latched on. So some of it was really, I mean, we were literally giving it away. I think, I don't think we really like intended to, make money on it, or really sell it in much capacity. We gave it to lots of different groups to use as fundraisers. We gave it to like almost universally locally, to groups for free, to give away or whatever. There was some like individual sales at like a coffee shop, but, yeah. And then, I think just like with Twitter and stuff, I think it got a lot of attention there, and, Emergent Goods has been, nice in like helping us sell individual copies, because the logistics of that would have been a real nightmare for us to take care of.
Yeah. And in terms of like putting it together, I was just really amazed by how many awesome submissions we got last year. I mean, there was like really good stuff that we weren't able to fit into the almanac. And like, I'm super proud of everything that people submitted that we were able to fit in there. And one of the most rewarding parts of it for me was kind of like, you know, having a little bit of a back and forth correspondence with, you know, different authors and kind of like workshopping certain aspects of the pieces with them and, you know, getting everything to fit together nicely. So I'm definitely looking forward to that again for this year. And in terms of the October 31st deadline that we announced, I don't think that should hold people back. If somebody hears this podcast and that's only a couple days from now, like I think we can maybe fudge the deadline a little bit if people want to submit something, because, you know, it doesn't seem like we have quite enough submissions yet to fill out the whole 2022 almanac. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd definitely say if if anyone's listening is, you know, psyched about the idea of doing something, it's pretty, like, we're asking for about 750 words, somewhere around there. So it's, you know, like a pretty manageable, amount of work. And, the deadline, really, if you can just get at us within, you know, by the end of October or around there, even if it's a little later, it's probably fine. Just get at us and like send us an email like, hey, I'm thinking about writing something about XYZ. And then we can at least like start a conversation about like what needs to get done. But unlike last year, we are going to really try and shoot for that like January, printed, released, out there, kind of vibe. Yeah.
Curious to know what people said about it when they got a chance to get a hold of it. Was it a lot of people that were already doing kind of like land or gardening projects, or was it people that wanted to kind of get into that, or both?
I was really into the getting responses from people who had kind of found us on Twitter. I'm kind of like generally like to stay off social media as much as possible. I very much am in favor of print just because I can read it better, and like I just like am kind of like a nerd like that. But having the established Twitter and Instagram or whatever, we started getting people from like small towns across the Southeast who wanted some for like their garden clubs, or like wanted to give some to like some specific friends, or like, you know, kind of just like these people who are in, you know, maybe a space that like they're not coming across this type of thing in their day to day that much, and usually seek it out online, and being able to create that connection, which is like, I personally have met people in different states by like, oh, well, I happened to be driving through that state and I had them and they wanted some. So we just linked up and chatted, and like making connections like that, I still keep up with some of these people and have seen their gardens and seen what they're up to. And we kind of like brainstorm what works and what isn't working for us, or, you know, just it as like kind of having a way of getting like a foot in the door to start a conversation, I think has been the most exciting part for me, I think.
Well, anything else you want to say just on the print project itself before we kind of transition?
Yeah, just to encourage people to reach out. They can email lobeliacommons@protonmail.com, or they can message us on social media if that's easier for them. We'll just redirect you to the email eventually. Really open to a lot of different subjects. It could be, you know, some kind of like analysis about agroecology. It could be like a how-to instructable. Even people like, if you just like notice something in the last X number of years about climate change and are like, you know, it was really weird when this thing bloomed in January or whatever, you know, stuff like that. Or, you know, historic dates. There's a lot of different information we try and pack in there. And I think if folks have seen the first one, which they, if you haven't, on Emergent Goods, they have like a PDF on there, I think. And so you can look at it for free. And so you can kind of get an example of what's already in there and then see some of the other stuff. I mean, there's like also graphs and stuff. So if you have a particular, piece of information that you would like to see visualized, I mean, we have some designers that maybe could like put it together. So really, really want to encourage people to like consider a wide variety of what a submission could look like. And additionally, one kind of like pie in the sky dream we have is to eventually get it online. And none of us are really like computer. I mean, a few of us are designers, but none of us are like computer literate in that way. So also, if anyone is down to like donate some time to help get it online somehow, reach out, send us an email. That'd be sick.
You know, since we talked, you know, one of the big things that happened in New Orleans was that Hurricane Ida struck southeast Louisiana. There's an article up on CrimeThink. We'll link in this podcast, but it's called The View from New Orleans, about kind of an anarchist mutual aid responses to that. You all are mentioned in there. So let's just kind of go back and walk us through kind of the first initial days of the disaster. I mean, it was pretty intense. Seems like there was like weeks without power. And then we'll kind of get into what you saw from the ground.
I also actually live outside of town. I moved out of the city during the pandemic. But so I arrived actually like the day after the storm, and immediately had linked up with my old neighbors who I kind of keep up a relationship with personally, and was really just surprised at the gap between basically like the national media dialogue about it, conflating regions that were like nowhere near each other in terms of the conditions that were being faced, while also getting text messages from friends who are like paramedics, you know, talking about the actual conditions, or like sending me a video of them like laughing while the roof blew off of their the building they were in, and but also kind of terrified at the same time. So like feeling that kind of uncertainty, there was this very ominous feeling that like this was a different type of storm. Even in the days leading up to it, kind of everyone had this like feeling in their gut. And so, yeah, the first thing that I personally did, and we ended up as a group kind of getting going on, was, supporting some neighbors. So like our Lobelia is like a network for food autonomy and neighborhood survival. So I feel like we kind of kicked more into gear on that second part. And linked up with a lot of my old personal neighbors. So like got gas to some people. We linked up with Vince Althea, who we're working with now, who she's kind of like, she's just been like holding down this specific block in the South 7th Ward for decades. She lives in, the house that she grew up in that her mom bought, single mother in the 60s. And really, I mean, the city's obviously like all cities are rapidly gentrifying, especially in this area. And so that relates to like the, like historical, march into the swamp in New Orleans. So like most of the areas that are closer to the river are on high ground. And so therefore, like during Katrina, for instance, received less water. And as you got further and further away from the river, like towards the lake, which of course isn't a lake, it's an estuary, so it's like connected to the Gulf and receives floodwaters from storm surges. As you get further and further away from the river, the land goes down. And that has been exacerbated by development, pulling water out of what was marshes and is now the suburbs. So basically post-war suburbanization, like instead of Levittown, you have like Gentilly and Lakeview and these areas that are closer to the lake. So if you had wealth post-war, you typically went to these places, which eventually would become more vulnerable and flooded very severely during Katrina. So now after the lesson of Katrina, gentrification has rapidly accelerated in these areas that are closer to the river. So to get back to Althea, I mean, she's like really holding on, and she's been doing this stuff, you know, whatever the like quote unquote mutual aid, for decades. Like, she would never turn anyone away. She, you know, will run some kind of little like gray area business, you know, like a snack shop kind of thing, out of her backyard, or, you know, if anyone needs a place to stay, there's always people who are experiencing houselessness coming in and out of her place. She's just like a really, really great person. And I've been lucky to know her for, maybe about 7 years now. And so we kind of got quick to work of trying to see that some of these resources were coming into the city and going to various larger groups, and tried to, just get some of that for her. 'Cause she's, rather than trying to set up like a new mutual aid group or something or whatever, for the storm, just get the resources to the people who are already in community. You don't need to make it up. You don't need to make a new thing. Don't need to reinvent the wheel. So we started this fundraiser and got some money for putting a new roof on her house, her mom's house, and, began linking up with other groups in the region that are kind of like-minded, working towards making sort of autonomous hubs of people in different neighborhoods that are staying. They've already been in community. They just need some access to resources. to get stuff like solar power or like a supply line for food or gasoline or just like some of the resources that lots of groups were getting, and that people who maybe aren't affiliated with like a quote unquote political mutual aid group would be getting. So that became the goal for Althea's house, was to fix the roof, gut all the moldy stuff that's been in there, the drywall and all that, fix the insides, put solar on it, and start developing a decent sized garden so that not only would she be energy autonomous, she'd also be like food autonomous. And knowing that that's not just her, knowing that she's in community with a lot of people. I mean, you sit on her porch for like, I don't know, 15 minutes. I was there for maybe about 10 minutes earlier today. People are just stopping and, you know, honking like, hey, baby, and like just constantly coming and going because she's like been that rock. So anyone who's been in that neighborhood knows her. So that's basically what we got to. And then shortly after that, once we set that up, we started breaking off some extra time to go support some what would become friends down in the United Homa Nation at the Akania Kalana farm space outside of Homa. And the storm out there is radically different than what happened to New Orleans. Basically, New Orleans, you had like this severe infrastructural failure of like the electrical grid going out because the transmission line went, the main transmission tower fell into the Mississippi River, making it so most of New Orleans didn't have power for about 9-10 days, something like that. Whereas down in Homa, that was a lot, that was eye of the storm, that was a lot closer to the coast, a lot higher winds. I mean, there's places that are only just now getting power back on, that are only just now getting water back. The level of devastation of the wind experience there alone is like much higher. So that became apparent that needed to become like a long-term kind of hub for moving people and supplies and stuff like this. So they're actually still doing that every day. We go down there a little bit, but they would be better to talk about that, but still moving gasoline, still, you know, rebuilding. They're looking for volunteers and, you can find them online.
Yeah, I'll just add real quickly. I spent a little bit of time in Puerto Rico after this earthquake, just prior to the pandemic, and got to visit a lot of the centros de apoyo mutuo around the island, the mutual aid centers, where, you know, after a lot, folks probably know, after Maria, people took over a lot of abandoned public buildings and stuff that had been abandoned often since prior to the storm due to austerity and things like that, and turned them into these really incredible mutual aid centers that became the basis for a lot of the things that have happened since then. I can say myself, and I think maybe other people, you know, that we work with have definitely been like inspired by that model. And, you know, despite the fact that New Orleans has like a ton of abandoned schools that are just still abandoned from when they turned everything into charter schools after Katrina, the move, you know, kind of following what people just in the neighborhoods and the streets are doing, you know, hasn't been kind of the exact same thing of like literally taking over some schools or something like that. But, you know, it is more this thing of like finding these existing places that already serve that purpose and really just kind of organizing on that basis of friendship and trying to like build up those spaces. And then, you know, once we reach that level of autonomy, like hopefully we can use that as a model to kind of move on to the next place and start to like create more and more of these hubs or assist more of these hubs that already exist.
Yeah, there's a few that have been popping up out in La Place. I believe there's like a cafe that, that way was becoming kind of like a hub for at least for a response specifically. And there's a spot out in the east. I think it's like an old gas station that someone has been using as specifically to get like kids cool. They had like air conditioning and generator and stuff so you could get kids cool and so they're not like stuck sweltering. This is really, really hot in August, September in New Orleans. Yeah, and so I think trying to like support these spots that are already doing that. One group that's like particularly focused on that is Cooperation New Orleans. They've been doing a lot of that kind of like networking side of things to promote that. So that way, when this does happen again, some of that legwork has already been done, and some of those connections have already been fostered.
Well, you mentioned Puerto Rico. I find that fascinating. We did a whole like 2-hour podcast with somebody on that. As well. It sounds like maybe your experiences are a little later than theirs, but I'm curious if you saw any similarities between the two situations. I mean, you brought up, for instance, like, I guess it's been referred to as like the shock doctrine or like the post disaster rush by capital to like buy up stuff and increase gentrification and push people out. I'm curious, you know, if you saw similar stuff between either the response from the state or from the people in between the two examples of Puerto Rico and also New Orleans, or lack of response from the state.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a little bit of a difference in scale just in terms of like how totally catastrophic Maria was. And, you know, in like New Orleans, it was bad to have power out for 2 weeks, 3 weeks for people. But, you know, I know it was a lot worse for people in Puerto Rico. I mean, one thing that I've noticed kind of as a constant of lots of the different disasters that I've tried to help out with afterwards, is kind of there's always this like moment of just like, you know, this kind of chaos, this frenzy, like right afterwards, where like people all over the country, all over the world are like trying to, you know, find out how to help. They want to send money. They want to send resources, whatever. And oftentimes, like, the information that's going around, like, in the really early stages of that are, like, you know, often, like, organizations who are more active on social media than they are in real life and who are more able to, you know, go out and sort of, like, send out the memes or the little Instagram flyer or whatever and get everybody hyped. And often those organizations are not actually the ones that are the most rooted in the communities and are the most rooted in people's own efforts to take care of themselves and their neighbors. And like, personally, I try to wait a little bit to sort of see what arises and see what actually needs supporting organically. Like, one thing that really bummed me out about this storm was just how much money I saw Cajun Navy raising online. And like, Cajun Navy sounds cool, you know, they've got great branding or whatever, but they're like very much like 3%er adjacent. And, you know, they have in fact, like, you know, rescued people in their boats in other storms. They didn't in this one. You know, they put out all of their things saying, oh, we're going to help, you know, send us all your money. People send them tens of thousands of dollars. And then they're like, oh, actually, well, we can't really get out until tomorrow, because, you know, it's too dangerous to go out tonight. And then by the next day, the floodwaters have receded and they didn't rescue anybody, but they still raised tens of thousands of dollars. And so, yeah, I mean, that kind of, it's not just like the big time, you know, capitalist shock doctrine folks who are, you know, taking advantage of these situations. It's also people who we maybe could think of as being kind of adjacent to mutual aid, but, you know, don't really have any of the same principles. And yeah, I would just hope that people kind of watch out for that sort of thing in the future.
Yeah, it gets really tough because all this money starts pouring in. And, you know, like, in some ways we had the benefit of over the course of the pandemic, like, a number of these mutual aid groups had popped up. So they already had infrastructure, like, you know, NOMAG, for instance, New Orleans Mutual Aid Group. I mean, they've just been doing this since the pandemic started. And they have like a, you know, like a walk-in cooler and stuff. So they have the infrastructure to acquire stuff. And, you know, there's like access to space to store stuff. And, so that's great. But, you get people from, you know, all over the country that are panic trying to give money to wherever. And they want to send it to the right place. But sometimes even sending it to the right place, you can end up with, a problem of having too much money. Like, I'm pretty glad that we actually didn't really get that much because, I wouldn't want to have had to have dealt with it of, you know, suddenly everyone sees that you have all this money and you have to spend it instantly. If you don't spend it instantly, then, you're being problematic or something. And a lot of these groups just aren't used to having budgets like that or facing with the issues of having to grapple with, you know, suddenly there's like a million Venmos to give money to and, you know, which ones do you get? So then their entire, you know, quote unquote work, you know, becomes maybe less quote unquote, is to just sift through Instagram and be like, all right, well, this one looks legitimate. This one doesn't. And like, that's what they're doing instead of, stuff just like in their community. Yeah, and in some ways for me, I felt like having Lobelia as like this kind of organization or whatever that we could use to get some kind of, you know, it's like a stamp of approval or something. Like there's something behind the fundraiser. But going into the city, it was just me looking for my neighbors and trying to talk to them and see what they want to do and try and make whatever that they needed to happen. Make it happen and use the org as a way to get that to happen, to get it into the community.
Cause the first week or two, it is triage. It is an emergency. It is really important to get resources out to people, but like a lot of those resources, it's totally different than the sort of things that are needed to actually build autonomy and build power and resiliency for the next storm. So it's like, you know, a lot of that stuff, like if there isn't a little bit of take a step back, take a deep breath, kind of plan out, like, you know, what can we put these resources to that's going to help people get through this storm, but it's also gonna have something left over. So
yeah,
you know, direct aid is important and stuff too, but yeah, it often does fall into this problem of like, the only people who are getting the direct aid are the people whose Venmo went viral in some particular Twitter post or something. And then There's a lot of other people who, you know, if there isn't somebody who is a conduit between the outside world and that particular neighborhood or that particular community or something, there's so many people who get left out by that process.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's why, like, I'm really impressed with, what Cooperation New Orleans was doing, by specifically like linking up with these, spots that can become long-term autonomous hubs, because the focus therefore became, okay, yeah, we're going to like, you need water. All right, let's talk to the people in the, whatever the signal chat that have access to the water. We get the water from that group. We give you the water. What else can we do? You know, like let's one up it. I think the way that we've been talking about Althea's house has been like when the rest of, the South 7th Ward lose power, like all the Airbnbs and rich people's houses that moved into the neighborhood, when they all lose power, LP is going to have her lights on drinking a cold beer, because she's going to be like completely autonomous. And so like doing that times, what they're focused on is like long-term kind of like basically like survival skills. And like, you know, there's this thing in New Orleans, I'm not sure, and it probably exists elsewhere, but it's always like prep your hurricane box or whatever, which is like put a flashlight with some batteries and some cans of soup or something in there. It's woefully limited for the world that we live in. It's yes, okay, it can get you by through a few days, but the world we're walking into is one of that hurricane box needs to be obliterated. It needs to become the stuff of everyday life. You know, it needs to become incorporated to the ways that you talk to your neighbor, rather than the ways a lot of people don't. It needs to become something that's like a lived practice. And I'm starting to see that with like, as opposed to all the other, kind of like hurricane recovery, quote unquote, efforts I've been a part of through the years. I've started to see that in New Orleans this year. There's been like a lot of hardship and a lot of like, I know a lot of friends are really going through some hard stuff right now. And a lot of friends like had damage to their houses and stuff. And so it's really, really heartbreaking. There's been like a lot of sadness and, not to discredit, put that down or forget about that, but I really have seen people in their position towards the world generally, but also catastrophe or inclement scenarios has been often towards long-term preparedness and autonomy and building power, which it requires being social and like working with your neighbors and like getting to know people and just like having barbecues. I think one of the most beautiful things that happened during the storm or after the storm, I mean, is pretty much every single day. Like, so there was the curfew. I think it was at 8. It was like basically at sundown or like a little bit after. There basically like everyone would be having like a barbecue at like 6:30 or 7. And so everyone would be grilling after like going out and chainsawing stuff or like, I don't know, tarping people's roofs or driving, you know, all over the place, taking supplies and stuff. And then you'd come back and there would just be tons of food, either from like the weird nonprofit food that was just like trickling through everyone. And, or people were like clearing out their freezers and fridges and stuff. So there's just like really fancy meats a lot of times, or just like, I don't know, like the supplies were coming in and people were able to cook stuff. So people would literally just barbecue hop and then, you know, go back home during the, you know, after curfew. And it was like really nice. Like I saw people, like people's neighbors walking up and being like, "Hey, I always thought y'all were cool, but like, you know, I was always a little bit intimidated, but you seem like great people and, you know, end up making friends like that." And that is something that I'm definitely going to remember next time there's a storm.
Walk up to you with point blank range of five burners. Walk away like nothing happened. Walking while I'm clapping, laughing while I'm talking. Awesome with the magnet, spasm with the forfeit, caution with the asthma. The OG Kush, we smoke, ascend your lungs into a spasm. Live fast, we die young. A bunch of live guns, get your mind flung through space and time. When we ride, run for the hills. Iron Maiden, dying pain. Have the entire society riding, flipping over cars violently. The fiery, the double gun salute. 100 guns asking, who the fuck is you? We the top tier, you can get your head popped here. Stop there, we can earth you and nobody would care. And that's deeper than the unborn in the womb of a prawn. At the bottom of the Indian Ocean in the calm.
Anywhere I want, I don't have clearance. Carnivore don't eat anything that don't have parents. I'm jihadist, I go to war with Godfarers. Elohim, Rhodes, Crucians, and Crossbearers. I don't sign up for war, it's no enlistment papers. My hands fast, they pyrotechnic initiators. I don't have any close friends, just distant neighbors. Cause I don't listen to Christians or crucifixion waivers. I don't listen to anyone that ain't been to war. I don't listen to anyone if they ain't been poor. I ain't never going back to where I've been before. And I ain't going fucking back to lose, win, or draw. Tell your whole fucking fam Vinny P a problem. And my 4/5 sick, it got a sneezing problem. It's the heavy metal king, you know that we a problem. Hey, y'all ain't saying shit, now y'all have a breathing problem. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask, you know, you mentioned that the power was off for a while. I'm just curious, you know, what was that experience like? Was it only in certain parts of the city? And also, I'm curious, you know, how the state responded in that situation. Like, did it really try to impose itself in a way to stop looting? Was it kind of non-existent in some ways? What did that look like?
I mean, my limited experience being in the part of the city I was in a few days after the storm, I mean, it seemed like power was out almost everywhere, at least all the residential areas. There might have been some business district or something that got it back pretty soon, but definitely the only presence of the state was the anti-looting patrols that were ubiquitous, at least where I mean, there was tons of cops driving around with their spotlights on, just shining them around, like prepared to hassle people for being out after curfew or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, there was like basically a lot of like private security or, you know, like mercenary kind of vibe people. Like at every AutoZone, pretty much, there would be like a, you know, a brand new F-150 with lights on, just parked right in front of the door all night, and just like one guy in it. And there'd be, if it wasn't them, it would be like National Guard and the police and stuff. But yeah, the power was out for the entire city minus the French Quarter. The French Quarter got power back, I think, within a couple of days.
I'm curious also, you mentioned how you took like existing projects and sort of injected them into the situation.
Yeah, so like I think the pandemic brought a lot of people together in some ways, like just the surge of like volunteer people, and like suddenly everyone knew what mutual aid was, or like, you know, thought they did or something, and you just got to that type of activity. And so there had been like these like calls and stuff throughout the pandemic where like people would be keeping in touch, and it was usually not very much in terms of like, it wasn't very effective in those moments of like orchestrating much collaboration, aside from like, hey, we've got too many carrots, can we bring them to your fridge or something like that. And I think for us being part of like a more agriculture focused project, I think oftentimes we were like a little bit doing something that was like a little bit different or something, and therefore like people didn't, the other groups maybe didn't really, they were like, oh, I'd love to go out and get my hands dirty, but I don't, you know, I don't know when, I don't know when I'll have time. So we didn't, you know, we kind of had these relationships prior, but weren't, they weren't really like tested or something. But then with the storm, I mean, we then had all these people's numbers in our phones and stuff. And maybe people who, you know, had driven deliveries for one of the, mutual aid groups, you know, maybe they're suddenly getting really interested in like doing a lot of stuff. So, like we held, like a chainsaw safety workshop for all these people going out with like brand new, they just bought chainsaws and they're trying to like take down some sketchy trees and stuff. And, you know, it's super dangerous, situation, obviously. So we did this like workshop, and, you know, I was really impressed with like the folks that showed up, who, you know, you definitely would have seen at some stuff, but got really activated by the moment. Yeah, I don't know, maybe you can add something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can add too much to that, other than that I have just been super impressed by a lot of the existing mutual aid groups, like NOMAG being one example, that just stepped up into the new roles that were presented by the disaster. And like, I don't quite remember the numbers, but like people were keeping track of how many tarps they had put on roofs. And I think even to this day, they, you know, people in just a few different mutual aid groups have put way more tarps on roofs than FEMA has.
Yeah. And, I bet.
Yeah, like no doubt. And that, and like that was also because like they were putting tarps on roofs like, you know, within 2 or 3 days after the storm. FEMA, I don't think, could claim to have like actually tarped anybody's roof through the Blue Tarp program until, I don't know, at least like 2 weeks or maybe even like a month after or something. Like they were incredibly slow to respond to this, and, you know, yeah, people on the ground were way ahead of them.
Yeah, I think that like really more than any sort of like political or like official like org or mutual aid group or something, I think really it was like the folks who maybe just, you know, have always kind of been around and like you know, just in their neighborhoods or something, or maybe are listless or something. I think a lot of people found meaning suddenly in like tarping roofs or going out and helping people, or even just like making sure that the barbecues happened, or, you know, suddenly like not only knew their neighbors' names, but like felt invested in, their neighbors' well-beings and stuff like that. I think that those connections are going to be like the lasting ones, because as like these political formations, you know, come and go as they do. You know, if you continue to live in that spot, you know, you have the same stakes, kind of. You know, your next door neighbors, your friends, you know, you're facing the same lack of power and whatever.
What would you say that you all learned out of this experience, if anything, or lessons that you would encourage other people to kind of build on?
Time and time again with hurricanes, I've just seen so much resources come in, and just kind of feel like they fell out of the back of a truck kind of thing. Or, you know, feeling good in terms of like what was being done with those resources at the time. But then, you know, turning around a couple of weeks later, a couple months later, and being like, well, where did all that go? And I think keeping sights on the fact that like, we are here. I mean, we're staying here. This is, you know, where we are kind of making our stand or something. And, the disaster is one that has been lived for hundreds of years. And, you know, it doesn't come with the hurricane. The hurricane just like, you know, changes its flavor a little bit. So like, how do we continue to live, and how do we like keep our eyes set on what the future is? How do we like, bring those resources into something that doesn't just fizzle away? Because we aren't going to get many more shots at this. In some ways, for us specifically here, Ida was kind of like, it was like a blessing in disguise in some ways for New Orleans specifically, because it wasn't a Katrina. Like, it looked like what could have happened to New Orleans specifically, could have been something like Katrina. Now, I should say, you know, down the bayou, the river parishes, that was their Katrina. But speaking from New Orleans right now, like there's a decent chance that should another storm like Katrina hit here, there, you know, the rebuilding may not happen in the same way. So looking forward towards building long term in ways that, keeps room for like a kind of imagination that isn't, sort of imprisoned by the infrastructure that's failing around us. Because if we allow that to happen, when the infrastructure does fail again, and we know it will, then we have no choice but to move back into the arms of wherever the state can keep us safe. So choosing to live against that means continuing to build for a long-term autonomous power. And I imagine that is true in places that aren't facing hurricanes, that are maybe facing flash floods or facing wildfires or droughts or whatever.
Yeah, I definitely want to second that the importance of like orienting a response towards kind of like the long term disaster that we're all living under. And not to say that it's not important to like to try to respond to like the immediate needs or whatever, but one thing I have noticed that is like really consistent across a lot of different types of, you know, disasters or crises that I've been a part of in one way or another, is that sometimes the situation is just changing so rapidly, but that by the time you orient yourself to what was happening yesterday, the situation has totally changed. Like, you know, this time around, for example, there was like a huge gas shortage within the city, like right after the storm happened. And like, if you had been there and you'd been ready and you had a ton of gas, you know, you could have made a huge difference giving gas to people who needed it to get out of the city and stuff like that. And you know, you might also have to be careful too, because there were people kind of like scalping gas for like several hundred dollars for just to fill up a car or something. But then like, you know, if we rush and all try to like get a bunch of gas, and by the time we get into the city, like the situation has changed and they're filling up the gas stations again. And that's not so much the issue anymore. Now everybody needs a generator, and then you rush, you try to get a generator, and by the time you get a generator, people are starting to get power back, and at least in that case, you have a generator for the next time or something, so at least that response is, like, somewhat oriented kind of to the long term or whatever, but it's, like, on the one hand, if you can be, like, prepared beforehand and, like, have everything ready, like, to respond in those first few days or something before the situation changes and then changes again and then changes again, that's, like, super critical and can be super helpful. But if you're not able to react with that speed or move or have the resources to do that, it can definitely be better to, like, take a step back and start to think about what it means long term to respond.
Yeah, and I think where that was most successful in our case, and honestly is, like, still happening, is where there's been, like, connections regionally, and that, like, the city is not an island, even though, like, they used to call it, like, the island of New Orleans. It's connected to the region that surrounds it, and kind of making connections to farms and, like, people who live outside of the city, or, you know, land projects or what have you, like, having direct connections to people that have access to supply lines that the city doesn't. We were able to move a lot of gas from, like, southwestern Mississippi and, like, near Hattiesburg and southern Mississippi, just elsewhere that hadn't been impacted quite as much by the storm. I think that this is still happening, in that, like, we are still going from New Orleans down to Yakani Ekalana, outside of Houma. And, you know, they like, didn't have access up until pretty recently. They didn't have access to a lot of these, like, typical supply lines, like conventional supply lines that we did. And, like, there became a moment where suddenly gas was back in New Orleans. And so if you had gas in your car, you were taking it to Houma. And so then moving gas from New Orleans to Houma and stuff like that. So we know next time, should the storm be a little bit further east, we know that there will be that connection, bringing gas back.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at @IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show. You know, you mentioned going back to Puerto Rico, just the importance of seizing those buildings that turned into the Centers for Mutual Aid. I'm just curious, you know, when do you think we'll get to the point where people are doing that in the U.S., and why aren't we at that point already?
For me, I think one of the differences is just kind of, like, I mean, I haven't spent enough time in Puerto Rico to, like, really be sure about this comparison, but I think part of it has to do with just how much more resources the police and the state have in the continental U.S. to crack down on that kind of action. And also the fact that, like, in Puerto Rico, by the time the storms had even happened, like, the level of disillusionment with the government and with the government response was just, like, so incredibly high. Like, it's like nowadays, like, if you meet somebody in Puerto Rico who supports the government, it's literally probably because they work in. They're like one of the tiny percentage of people. Like, everybody understands that the state is a complete failure. And I definitely think we're moving towards that point elsewhere in the U.S. But yeah, I think it is partially the balance of forces of, like, how much sort of repressive power they can put out there against these sort of efforts.
This situation in New Orleans is not doesn't fit that well. I mean, like, in terms of, like, going down the path of, like, eventually getting like the mutual aid centers or what have you, just because. Especially with Ida, like, there was a lot of people did evacuate. And it was, like, a suggested evacuation or whatever. So you had a lot of people, and, like, first thing they could do once they could get gas was to get out of the city. Because they knew it was going to be a long time that there wasn't going to be power. So there was just, like, very few people. And on top of that, some of the infrastructure that existed was like warehouse space already to like make that stuff happen. So it wasn't like a feasible possibility or really much of a need specifically. But I think in terms of like hating the government or what have you, I mean, there's probably few cities in the country that hate the government more than New Orleans, because of the history. If it wasn't like Betsy, it was Katrina, and they get lumped together, like they being like the Army Corps of Engineers, the city of New Orleans, the police department, Entergy, the energy corporation, all these like colonial manifestations, like all get lumped together, and you still hear it. I mean, like we were having a barbecue at Althea's place last week, and there was an elderly woman there who was just still talking about how they bombed the levee in Katrina. And, you know, obviously that's like kind of a myth that I don't think anyone should try and like prove wrong, but that is very much present, especially amongst Black New Orleanians. Obviously there is like this kind of culture war thing where like there is like at the same time, like they bombed the levee, but also maybe Blue Lives Matter at the same time. And, there are a lot of contradictions therein, but I don't think that would honestly, should like a scenario present itself, I don't think that would prevent people in New Orleans from like stop, like not, taking over a school or whatever. But it's something that like, I lived across the street from an abandoned school that, not only the police, but the National Guard would use as a shooting range, to train, they said that they would take in like school principals and stuff to like show them what a school shooting sounds like or whatever. I don't know, but they would be shooting at like all hours of the day. And, it's been empty pretty on and off since Katrina. There's been like little charter schools here and there for like a year or two, and then they moved. But there's been so many times that people like from that block who went to that school in like the 70s or 80s, would be like, there's tons of houseless people. We should just put them in there. You know, like that's been suggested to me so many times. It's not like there's just a few of these schools because of, like the charter schoolification or whatever of New Orleans. There's a lot of these schools around, these abandoned schools.
You know, one other big question I wanted to ask before we sign off. There was an article that came out about 2 days ago. It says most major economies will produce more than double the amount of coal, oil, and gas in 2030 than is consistent with meeting climate goals set by the 2015 Paris Accord to curb global warming. You know, we're just coming up to the COP meeting around climate change. I don't know. I'm just like... This isn't like any groundbreaking statement on this podcast, but it seems as if the corporate and political elites offer no solutions, and we continue to head towards very bad times in terms of the climate. You know, I'm just curious your thoughts again after like going through this experience and kind of like looking on the horizon about what lies ahead.
I mean, one of the most devastating things that I have like barely even had time to process or think about, and has gotten some news attention, but it's like there's so many other things that are more immediate to people's lives that we don't really hear about it. But like just the amount of toxic that was spilled into the Gulf or released into the air, either because of the storm, you know, damaging facilities like, you know, near the port, power plants and refineries and things like that, or kind of just the aftermath where, you know, the process of like turning off and turning back on these refineries is like incredibly filthy and releases like way more toxins and everything. I don't really have any like hopeful kind of solutions to pose or anything, but like I definitely think it's like it's worth thinking about ways that we can kind of you know, act in concert with these sort of like incredible destructive forces of nature that are like often, you know, destroying these infrastructures in really dangerous ways that end up like spilling all this gross shit. But like, you know, it would be really amazing if there could be some storm where afterwards, like, we could just kind of, people could take a stand and be like, no, we're not going to turn that one back on. No, we're not going to actually fix that thing back up. Like, that was bad. Like, you know, the areas like St. James, like other places that are like known as Cancer Alley or whatever, like it's palpable when you go to these places. Like if you aren't from there and you spend a day there, like you will have some sort of symptoms or some sort of headache or something that is like, you know, your body's not used to it. The people who are there like kind of only notice how bad the air is if they actually can get out for long enough that they can recover a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a huge issue that needs to be addressed. And it's so much of it is here. Like so much of the petrochemical infrastructure of the United States is on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, I think that that's something that definitely, you know, as we talk about like, you know, long term, you know, building power long term, like on our side, like watching what their playbook is a little bit, because, I mean, the general direction, I think we could safely say is going to be like less probably, production in the region. And it like, if that happens, then oil revenues are going to, or revenue from oil is going to, you know, drop off. And New Orleans, the main economy is tourism, and tourism's gone. So then it just basically becomes like a medical haven and a kind of a silly spot to have a medical haven. So that will inform like the fiscal crises that have happened in the city. Like right now, like, one of my closest friends is a paramedic, and, I mean, the conditions that they've been going through for like a year and a half straight is really, really, wild, just really next level. And like a lot of them got COVID because they're all living in the station during the storm, because there is power there. And, they're not getting paid enough, and it's going to continue to be the librarians, you know, they're not getting paid enough. Like pretty much every city worker, is not getting paid enough. And we were just talking about some people who are fixing the street, and they were like yelling on the phone, like, no one's showing up. I'm sick of this. You know, it's my like, you know, this is my third job and I can't get anyone to show up. And, you know, I hate this, like screaming on the phone, trying to fix the street by himself. and so that's just going to become more and more the case. I think everywhere, but in New Orleans, we'll see it a lot. So I think like, yeah, kind of like they were saying, keeping an eye towards like some hopeful things, is going to be really critical just for everyone's well-being. I personally was able to like get out into the swamp and see like a ton of trees that were still standing, and, like a lot weren't standing, but, trying to find those pockets where it's kind of like holding on.
Any other thoughts? Any other things you want to share?
Yeah. We've been spending a lot of time down, like outside of Houma with, on the Yakani Ekalana farm, and just want to like plug them. If anyone in the area is listening to this and is like looking to volunteer, they still need people to like be tarping roofs and delivering supplies. I think like any like skilled builders for sure they could use. You can find them online at Yakani Ekalana Garden. If anyone also is interested in helping work on Miss Althea's house or like can donate, we have a GoFundMe for Miss Althea's house. It's on Lobelia Commons, our like Instagram. For the almanac, definitely need submissions. So reach out.
And also if anybody's interested in distributing the almanac or maybe can help us fund the printing of this one ahead of time or something, reach out.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.